Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Oh, we're going to be in Leviticus 11 through 15 today. It really probably literary context should run through chapter 16, for it all has to do with the clean and the unclean. How do you deal with it? Chapters 1 through 7 were the sacrifices. How does man approach God? The different kinds. Chapter 8 through 10 is the consecration of the priest, and the great failure and the death of Nadab and Abihu. And then in chapters 11 through 15, we're going to get down the nitty-gritty of some of these clean and unclean, food laws, this and that. And the question has always been, why is this seemingly so irrelevant to us in the church today? Well, I must admit that there needs to be some symbolic understanding of what this means to us today. One of the best books I've ever seen on how to interpret the Old Testament is The Authority of the Old Testament by John Bright. It shows that we have to deal with principles instead of specific regulations. These two books that I've recommended to you earlier, the Tyndale Commentary and the New International Commentary, both try to put a Christian application on this. But I want to say to you, it's very tenuous at best, because you get 10 commentators, they'll give you 10 different symbolic representations. The problem with principalizing is you never know if you really have the mind and heart of God and the mind and heart of the original author, because you can make it say anything. So I'm very nervous about that, and I don't do a whole lot of that unless I can lock it down from the New Testament. It seems that chapters 11 through 15 basically develop out of chapter 10, verse 10, where it talks about make a distinction between the holy and the profane, between the clean and the unclean. Now, this idea of chapter 11 is going to be unclean and clean animals. Now, that goes back to Genesis. Remember that in Noah's Ark, there was that which was considered clean and that which was considered unclean, an animal. Exactly why that was clean and unclean, we don't know. In chapter 12, it's going to be about childbirth. In chapter 13 and 14, it's going to be about different kind of skin diseases, or mildew, or that kind of thing, because it's in a house and a garment too, and you can't get a skin disease in a house or a garment. And then chapter 15 is going to come back and give us some final requirements about purification from bodily discharges. This is going to be a rather uncomfortable lesson for you, because we're going to talk about things we don't normally talk about in the West. But again, I think it shows here this. God's people needed to be different. They need to be like God. God says, I'm holy, you must be like me. And so he makes his people distinct among all the surrounding peoples. As a matter of fact, the question has been asked over and over by commentators, what is the purpose of these food laws? How do you make a distinction between this animal and that animal? What's clean and unclean? Well, one reason I think is that the worship of the Canaanite religions, whatever they did, Israel was going to do different. And I think much of this, the reason we don't understand it, is because we don't understand Canaanite ritual. I think many of the animals were excluded because of the very fact they were involved in the Canaanite ritual. Now, of course, the reason that that's not an ultimate answer is that the bull was involved in Canaanite ritual, and a bull's involved in the Levitical system too. So that won't hold water completely. Some say, well, if it was different kinds of foods the Jews could eat and others could eat, then the Jews could not have intimate table fellowship with pagans. Now, there's another real possibility, not just emulating Canaanite pagan worship practices, but fellowship with Canaanites. In the New Testament, Acts 15 is all about how do Jews and Gentiles get along with table fellowship because of these food law kind of regulations. Another probability is health reasons. There was a book written several years ago called None of These Diseases by a medical doctor to try to explain that all of these rules had to do with hygienic or health purposes. Now, there are some that are obviously related to that, but not all of them. It won't work across the board. Someone said, well, it's probably this cultic reason, it's this health reason, and it's symbolic all together. There's some truth in that. Sometimes the actions of these animals, whether they ate dead things, carrion, or fish that ate dead things, versus animals that didn't do that, had a more normal, in the sense of non, what word should I use, not eating dead things kind of lifestyle. But there are still some other reasons, I think. Some say, as God limited man's food source in the Garden of Eden restricted the tree of knowledge of good and evil, to test man, that God limits some of the food here to test man. See if man's really serious about walking by faith, really serious about being his people. And that's a real possibility. Others have said, well, as these pastoral people, they normally ate sheep and the goats and the bulls from their flocks. That's what they normally ate. And the symbolism there was these sacrifices offered to God, that God also ate those. So because they're his people, they're going to eat the same kind of things that God eats. And that's why the food laws are limited to that which splits the hoof and chews the cud. Well, that sounds good, but of course deer is involved in this. Wild animals are involved in this, as the parallel of Deuteronomy 14 shows. So that won't hold water. The truth is, there is no good one explanation that covers all of these. There's a new book I was reading mentioned here in the New International Commentary series by Douglas that says it's those animals that have the normal kind of life. There are three kind of animals here: that which is on the earth, that which is in the air, and that which is in the sea. There is something about those who walk normally, walk with four legs, fly with two wings, swim with fins. If they have a normal way of travel, that's what's clean. Now, there may be some validity of that, but how in the world would you ever prove that? I don't know. I just don't know. Now, let's get back, if we could, to the text then. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron. Now, you say, well, usually God just speaks to Moses. One time he spoke to Aaron when Aaron didn't cry over the death of his sons. Why do Moses and Aaron both? Well, the same thing occurs in chapter 13:1, 14:33, and 15:1. It seems that Aaron is going to be involved in these food laws because the priest is going to be the one to have to make the official judgment whether somebody is clean or unclean based on the skin disease. And maybe that's why he addressed both. It seems in verse 2 here we have the kind of the key that's going to be followed through here. Speak of the sons of Israel, saying, these are the creatures which you may eat from all the animals that are on the earth. There's the first division. Look in verse 9. All the animals that are in the water. Look at verse 20. All the winged insects. Look at verse 29. The swarming things. Then again, verse 41. The things that swarm. Now, this seems to be, I'm not exactly sure how the division between 29 and 41 works out, but you see how he's breaking down the chapter. Now, it seems this follows the pattern of Genesis chapter 1, verse 20 through 30, about land animals, sea animals, and birds, or things that live in the air. And you might want to see Deuteronomy 14:6 as a parallel here. Okay? Whatever divides the hoof and thus splits the hoof and chews the cud among the animals, and the word here seems to mean domestic animals, and also wild animals, you may eat. Now, it's going to mention some things down here. It's going to say some things that can't be included. A camel, a rock badger, a rabbit, and a pig. Now, we'll say two things to you. Number one, the reason that only these four animals are mentioned, they're kind of halfway in between. Some of them chew the cud, they don't divide the hoof. Some divide the hoof, they don't chew the cud. So he kind of specifies exactly on these borderline animals. Now, the problem with a rabbit is that a rabbit doesn't chew the cud, but its mouth kind of goes back and forth. It seems the Hebrew idea here is that chews their food thoroughly instead of simply has a double stomach and ruminates. That's not really, because some of these animals don't do that. Now, some of these are like a rock badger. I must admit to you, these animals, we're very uncertain about exactly what particular species or animal it is. It's very difficult to lock these down. I was reading one of these commentators said that they think that from an expert in the field, about 40% of these animals and plants of the Bible we can be certain of. And I think that's probably a good guess. So we're very uncertain about what specific animals are covered here. But verse 3 gives the specifications for land animals. Notice it mentions down here the pig. Now, why is the pig caused such a problem in history? A lot of folks have eaten pig. We know that pig flesh was eaten back in Mesopotamia very early. Matter of fact, even before 3000 BC in Mesopotamia. We know in Egypt that swine flesh was considered sacred somewhere between 2700 BC and 2200 BC. We know that pigs will eat things other animals won't. They mature quickly. What is the problem with a pig? Here seems to be the problem. In Egypt, pigs were sacred, and their flesh was only eaten on certain festival days when it was dedicated to a god. You see the problem of the cultic side? Now look at the health side. The health side was that pigs carry any numerous kinds of diseases that even thorough cooking won't kill all of them. And so maybe it's a health reason. And beyond that, I just don't know why. I know they eat pretty cruddy food, and maybe again it's this idea, but they're close to eating carrion like some of these birds, and so they're just excluded because of their diet. I'm not sure. verse 8, "You shall not eat of their flesh, you shall not touch their carcasses, for they are unclean." Now, this is very important. There's two aspects here. Number one, they're not good for food, and number two, you can't even touch the dead body. Now, you could ride a camel, you could ride a pig if you wanted to. You just couldn't eat the sucker, and if it died, you couldn't touch it. You could touch it when it was alive, because the Jews had no problem selling pork meat to foreigners if they wanted to buy it, but they couldn't consume it themselves. You might want to see verses 24 through 40, which kind of specifies this in more detail. Now, we talk about fish in verse 9 and following, and here's the criteria for fish. They had to have fins, and they had to have scales. You might well see Deuteronomy 14:9, and again, further definitions found in verse 12. Notice it's in salt water and fresh water, the same kind of thing. So catfish is excluded, eels are excluded, any kind of porpoises are excluded, whales are excluded, because it's got to have fins and scales, and those that have smooth skin won't do that. Some say normally those animals without scales live in shallow water, eat dead food, and that's what excludes them. Again, is it health reasons? Is it because some fish were signs of deities? I'm just not sure. Notice verse 13. It mentions a series of birds here. Oh, we're just birds galore in 13 through 19. I have listed on the side of my Bible 20 different birds. Now, it says a bat here. A bat's not really a bird, but the Arabs also include a bat in their list of birds. All of these birds, and most of them are owls or falcons or buzzards or that kind of thing, vultures, they seem to be carrion eaters. And if you look at different translations, you'll see how wide the translations vary here. In verse 20 is certain insects. Now, what it does with insects, winged insects, the first kind, flying insects, it says the no if it walks on all fours, but yes if it hops. Now, hops, if the back leg is higher, kind of jointed, and it jumps, crickets and different kinds of locusts and those kinds of things are edible. John the Baptist ate locusts and honey. And this is what verse 21 specifies. Exactly why, we're not sure. Some say, I don't think it makes any difference what some say. The trick is these insects are eaten quite a bit in the ancient Orient. We even have some... Ashurbanipal, I think, had some crickets at one of his feasts with toothpicks in them. What delicacy delight that was. Well, yuck. I haven't eaten a cricket, but I haven't been real, real hungry either. Then in verse 24, "Moreover, you will be made unclean. Whoever touches the carcass or picks it up." Now, notice again, this is the idea of it. It's only till evening now. It's not a major violation, but it is a violation to touch it if it's dead or even to pick it up. Verse 29, it's swarming things. Now, again, it mentions things like moles and mice and lizards and geckos and some say crocodiles, but I think that's a poor translation. These are land scurrying things that just run all around. Some say the reason they're unclean is because they don't have any order to their lives. I don't know how we know. That's just kind of lost. Now, verses 32 through 35 kind of shows you the ceremonial nature of some of this. If one of these dead animals falls in on a piece of cooking utensils, you wash it off. But if it falls in a bowl, you have to break the bowl. If it falls on your oven, you've got to break your oven. Well, it seems to be something here, the communication of disease, but exactly how, I must admit, I'm not certain. Now, how do you deal with this if it touches a garment or a cooking utensil or a pot? Well, you either wash it, you break it, or you throw it out. And so it's a very serious thing. But notice it mentions here in verse 36, if it falls into a cistern, it doesn't make the cistern unclean. Because, boy, for a desert people with no water, one dead animal in a cistern, 1,000 of gallons of underground storage, would be a disaster for them. So if it's in a little pot and there's water or food in it and a dead animal is found in there, throw the whole thing out. Break the pot. But if it's in a cistern, somebody just get the dead animal out and that one person will be unclean till evening and then get on with your normal way of life. Shows a practicality here. Notice that verse 39 in farting shows that even clean animals, if you find them dead, become unclean. It seems to be that wholeness has something to do with this. The priest has to be physically whole. The sacrifices have to be unblemished. And here again, something of this clean and unclean has to do with the wholeness of the animal. Of course, a dead animal, whether it's clean or unclean originally, is suddenly unclean. And in verse 41, we have swarming things, and basically things that crawl on their belly, things that walk on all fours, and things with many feet. Yuck, who wants to eat them anyway? Not me. In verse 44 and 45, we see why this is true. It says, "For I am the Lord your God, consecrate yourselves. Be holy, for I am holy." Now this "be holy, for I'm holy" is repeated in verse 45. It's found in Leviticus 19:2, Leviticus 20, verse 7, and Leviticus 20, verse 26. God's people are to be different. They're to emulate Him. They're to be separate. That's true in the way they worship, in the way they eat, in the way they live. This covers every area of life. They're to be a peculiar people, as they were talked about in Exodus 19, verses 4, 5, and 6. In verse 45, it mentions here about the idea of bringing them out of Egypt. Shows they are uniquely God's people, because God in grace brought them out and made them His people. You know, I was reading this and I thought, people ask me sometime in churches, where does the Bible say that cleanliness is next to godliness? It doesn't. But this is as close as you get to it right here. Now, verses 46 and 47 are simply a summary of the whole chapter. Chapter 12 is a very short chapter, only 8 verses, and it deals with the birthing process. Why would a woman be considered unclean in the birthing process? Having children was considered to be a commandment of God back from Genesis 1, be fruitful and multiply. Children were considered to be a gift from God. Barrenness was considered to be a curse from God. So why does children make one unclean? Well, really, chapter 12 and chapter 15 ought to go together. Any bodily omissions made somebody ceremonially unclean. Now, the baby's not unclean, but the mother is, because of the afterbirth and the blood and the water that's involved. And it's a ceremonial cleanliness, not any sin connected with sexuality or the normal birth process or anything like that. Now, some say, well, why is the idea about 7 days and then 33 days for a son? 7 days, the woman was unclean to the extent that if she touched anybody or anything, they became unclean. But after the 7 days, she became unclean as far as worship or eating a peace offering, but she couldn't communicate that uncleanness. Now, it seems to be a 40-day waiting period for boys before she offers a sacrifice to bring her back into the community, but 80 days for girls. The question has always been, why are girls discriminated? Well, there's two possibilities. There's probably a whole lot more than that, too, that I know of. Number one is the idea that there is a discrepancy in the view of the worth of the sexes in the ancient world. It was a man's world. Number two, because a woman is going to have a menstrual period most of her adult life, that affects the view of her being somewhat more unclean. But now, what that involves, that has to do only with ceremonial uncleanness and nothing about God viewing women less or anything like that. Now, notice, if you will, the 8th day circumcision is mentioned in verse 3. It's a sign of the covenant. It began back in Genesis 17, 9 through 14 with Abraham. It's a very important day. The 8th day is why this little scripture here and back in Genesis is why the Jews do it on the 8th day as a child. It makes them part of the covenant. Everybody in the ancient Near East was circumcised except the Philistines, and they're, of course, from the Aegean. But the Jews did it very early as a religious symbol, not a rite of passage into puberty or manhood or something. Notice the idea in verse 6 about these turtle doves, a lamb a year old for a burnt offering. The burnt offering was a sense of thankfulness and joy. The woman has passed through this time of danger. The child's safe. It may be the ideal of a reinstatement to worship because she had to offer this sacrifice to be reinstatement. If you look at chapter 15, verse 31, the woman was a part of the community. She was not excluded during childbirth. And somehow the community and the sanctuary became unclean because of her. So the sin offering is not for childbirth, but to remove this ceremonially uncleanness from the whole group, the sanctuary itself, and her be brought back into fellowship. So the young pigeon or turtle dove is for a sin offering, and the lamb was for a burnt offering, a symbol of dedication back to God. Some say, why this long time? Now, I'm not a medical doctor, But some tell me that after birth, some women stop their discharge very quickly, but others it lasts for several weeks. And some have said the long period of time is to help that discharge stop completely, because any bodily emissions cause someone to be ceremonially unclean. Okay? Verse 8 again is the provision for the poor, and it shows God's love for all people and God's provision for those who don't have resources. Now, chapter 14 and 15 deal with a kind of skin disease. Now, it's translated leprosy, but the ancient word from the Greek lepra, it means many more skin diseases than simply what we know as leprosy. Matter of fact, some say leprosy is not included in here because it's a slow developing disease, and these seem to be something you can put a man away for 7 days and come and look and it'll progress and you can make a judgment. And leprosy is a very, very long term, slow moving disease. So some say it doesn't refer to leprosy, but psoriasis and eczema and scales and hives and stuff like that, okay? Again, it's symbolic of God's people needed to be different, holy, clean. So notice that the skin on the body is the idea. There, verse 1, there's a swelling or a scab or a bite spot, and it becomes an infection of leprosy, of this skin disease, a general skin disease. The man had to go to the priest. Now, somebody didn't bring him, he came himself, because he didn't want to pollute the whole community. Let me give you a brief outline of this, if I could. In verses 10 through 17, we talk about how a priest is to judge this. Deals with raw flesh. Verses 18 through 23 deals with boils. 24 through 28 deals with burns. 29 through 37 deals with head infections. And 38 and 39 deals with eczema. And there's a quarantine period. The priest will look at it. If there's certain criteria, say the hair is still black, he is to put him away for 7 days in quarantine, come back and look at him again. And so there's a different waiting period to make sure that what somebody really has or doesn't have. Let's see. By the way, this skin disease is going to have to cover garments or material and plants. So it obviously can refer, not plants, but houses. It can refer to mildew or something like that. Okay, it's very, very general here. I don't know what else to do for you. You can read this and see what it's saying. I used to have a guy who worked with me who was bald, and he used to love Leviticus 13:40, for it says, "He is bald, but he is clean." Well, baldness isn't the problem, but if you have scales and flakes and you're red in your head, and there was a lot of this in the ancient world because of the hygienic conditions, of course, then there was a problem. You had to be checked for this skin disease. Now, if you were considered to be have this skin disease, and it probably covers several different kinds, what happens to you in verse 45 and 46? Number one, you have to tear your clothes, sign of mourning. You have to let your hair go unkept, also a sign of mourning. You had to cover your mustache with your cloak and cry, "Unclean, unclean." You have to live alone and dwell outside the camp. Well, my word, this is serious. Now, we know from 2 Kings 7:3 there used to be colonies of lepers to help each other that kind of followed the Israelites and later had their own little places they lived. It was a terrible kind of way. We know Uzziah was a leper, for judgment of God fell on him. Leprosy is one of those things that some people say it is a divine curse like barrenness, but I don't think we can prove that from the Bible. The community felt like that the rights of the community overweighed the rights of the individual, and the individual was quarantined. And verses 47 through 59 is talking about a mark of leprosy or disease in a garment. And in verse 48, we have this word warf and woof, but I want to tell you, this is the only chapter in the whole Bible where this Hebrew word is used. We're not sure what it means at all. In chapter 14, it's about the cleansing of a leper. It's the ritual for cleansing. It's a very elaborate ritual that has much in common with the Day of Atonement and the ordination of the priest, because I think it was viewed as someone almost coming back from the dead. There was two birds involved. One was killed and the blood was shed, but one bird was let go in the field. I think we see that in verse 7. This may be a symbol of the leper who was trapped by his disease is now free. Or some say, no, it's like the Day of Atonement. The bird, the live bird, bore away the sin from the community. But we're just not sure. In verse 14, you see this strange thing that they put the oil on the right ear and the right big thumb and the right big toe. Why? Well, something of the dedication to God is very similar to how Aaron was anointed back in chapter 8, verse 24. He belonged to God completely, and this man is reinstored to the covenant community. In verse 33 and following, the rest of the chapter is about a house and what you do if your house gets a mark on the wall, mildew. I thought verse 36 was so practical. They said, "I emptied the house of all your possessions before the priest checks it." Because if the priest quarantines it, you can't use your normal possessions of life, like your pots and pans and your bed. So get them out of the house first, and then let the priest look at it and see if he has to quarantine it. You catch the idea of the practicality there? I loved it. In verse 45, it shows what happens if it comes back after being replastered. The stones have to be taken, the timbers, the plaster, taken outside the camp where it's unclean. Now, why that? Well, because that spot was unclean and nobody would reuse that building material, which would spread the fungus or mildew or whatever it is. In verses 48 through 53 is the sacrifice for a house, and it's very similar to the sacrifices earlier. Verses 54 through 57 is a summary. Now, chapter 15 is going to be somewhat uncomfortable for us. It deals with bodily discharges, and we in the West don't discuss that much. First, it deals with the man. A man who has a bodily discharge that happens every now and then, and one who has a long-term bodily discharge. Then to the woman has a short-term bodily discharge like her menstrual period, and then a long-term illness like the woman in the New Testament that touched Jesus' garment. And that's basically what this is about. Any discharge from the body made that person unclean. So verses 1 through 12 discuss that. Then verses 13 through 15 discuss the sacrifice for a man who has a bodily discharge. In verse 16 we have seminal emissions. You might want to see Deuteronomy 23:10. It seems that somehow the very act of making love, because there was some fluids of the body exchanged, that was ceremonially unclean. That's why you don't make love before you go to war and you consecrate yourself by staying away from a woman, that kind of thing. Notice, if you will, though, that even the normal act of making love you wash the bodies and you're unclean till evening. Some say the reason for that is to separate the sexual act from the worship act. And that may be true because of the Canaanite neighbors, but the Jews considered marriage the norm. Okay? Then we have the feminine discharge discussed, and you can read that. I don't need to talk to you about that. Verses 28 down through 30 is the sacrifice involved for women involved in that. Then the summary in verse 31 through 33. Notice this is very interesting in verse 31. "Lest they die in their uncleanness by their defiling of my tabernacle which is among them." Notice this ceremonial uncleanness had nothing to do with sin, but it had something to do about God's holiness. He symbolically dwelt in the middle of the camp in the tabernacle. People's personal uncleanness, and it was something that meant not normal wholeness. Whether it was sickness or lameness or dismemberment or some kind of skin disease, it made the camp unholy. And they were to be cleansed from this in the appropriate way so that God's people would be unique and the camp would be considered holy and clean and He would live there among them. Now, you say, "Well, Bob, tell me what this means to my day." Again, I think it talks about the seriousness of sin in approaching a holy God. It talks about that man continues to be sinful. It talks about that God has provided a way for us to approach Him. It talks about that God has provided for all men to approach Him, that God wants to dwell with us, but there are some rules and regulations that limit His presence with us. All of that, I think, can be drawn from this. But very specific interpretations that we say are in God's name bother me because we have no New Testament precedent, except that Jesus said that the food laws are no longer valid for us and that some of this has passed away. This is very cultural. It's very specific. It's very time-locked. I personally don't think the food laws are still a problem because the way Jesus dealt with them in Mark chapter 7 and in Acts 15. But you'll have to look at that on your own. I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again. Same time, same place. God bless you.